It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the World Bank says stagflation could be on the horizon for the global economy. An expert explains what that is and makes the case that the risks may be overblown. First, how much power do state and tribal governments have to block federally approved energy projects if they think it puts water at risk? The Biden administration proposed regulations that would give decision-making power back to state officials and tribal authorities. If passed, the proposal would undo regulations made by the Trump administration that restricted those powers. It's all part of the Clean Water Act passed 50 years ago. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think state and tribal governments should have the authority to block federally approved pipelines and other energy infrastructure? Why or why not? Who should be in charge of letting these things happen? What questions do you have about how all of this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Steph Tighe is a law professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, researching environmental and health sciences and administrative law. Steph, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, it gets a little complicated when you get federal government, state and tribal and environmental regulation. So I kind of want to take it back to the beginning. What is the authority that was part of this Clean Air Act back in the early 1970s that's getting this back and forth treatment from the two administrations here?
Yeah, so the Clean Water Act allows for the or requires the EPA to permit a number of different things, right? So if you're going to discharge point source pollutants, that is from a single pipe or something, into navigable waters, then you need a permit from the federal government. If you're going to do wet and filled wetlands kind of dredges, then you also need a permit from the federal government. And 401 is the permit section that allows for states.
And we've lost our guest there. We'll get back into this, maybe with a different connection, looking at the Clean Water Act. And as we were just about to hear, how it regulates approval of different kinds of energy infrastructure. That includes pipelines, an issue here in Wisconsin, of course. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions or thoughts on this, 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. This is a proposed rule change from the Biden administration, overturning a Trump administration rule change that changed the way this has worked since the passage of the Clean Air Act in the early 1970s. Coming up in just a bit, we'll be looking at the global economy and a prediction, a concern from the World Bank that we could be at risk of stagflation, a combination of inflation with slow growth, something we haven't really seen since the 1970s. Right now, talking to Steph Tighe, law professor at the UW-Madison, researching environmental health sciences, researching environmental and health sciences and administrative law, looking at this proposed rule change from the Biden administration. We'll get back to this conversation in just a minute. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Steph Tighe, law professor at UW-Madison, talking about a new proposal that, if approved, would give tribes and state officials more authority, restoring that authority to block certain energy projects that could impact water sources, including pipeline projects. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have thoughts on this. If you're wondering how it works, if you're wondering, what it might mean for Wisconsin? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Steph, before we lost you there, you were just about to get to the heart of this, talking about the 401 authority and the Clean Water Act. That's the central issue here we're talking about.
Yeah, sorry about the internet issues.
That's live radio. It happens.
Right. So the 401 authority is basically allowing for states and tribes to have input into the various other type permits that the EPA or Army Corps of Engineers issues, which is basically point source pollutant discharge permits and also wetlands dredge and fill permits.
How has that authority been used over the years until it changed, at least briefly, in the Trump administration?
Yeah, so what happens is that because these different types of permits have effects on state water quality and tribal water quality, the idea was under 401 to allow states and tribes to sort of demonstrate that kind of impact and evaluate whether or not that additional kind of discharge is going to affect the water quality standards. And so prior to the Trump administration, there was a sort of more ambiguous kind of thing, basically allowing states and tribes to have a reasonable timeline to certify whether or not it would have a negative impact on state or tribal water quality, and allowing them to sort of provide either vetoes or conditions on particular types of discharges. The Trump administration found this to be an abuse of the system. There was, like, for example, Washington denied certification for a proposed coal export terminal in 2017. New York denied certification for natural gas pipeline in 2018. And so this was seen as, by the Trump administration, as an abuse of the system. And so they created this rule, basically one saying, hey, states and tribes only have a certain amount of time to object to these things. And the outer bound is 1 year. And they drew this from a DC circuit opinion. And then two, that kind of certification decision, whether or not this discharge is certified or not certified, has to be based on specific discharges from a proposed activity, not the whole overall water quality effects, and also restricts the kind of conditions that the states and tribes may impose. So it's not just about whether or not something is approved, not approved, approved, but rather also these additional conditions that are applied. So they limited that, and they also put some restrictions on how long they have to make a decision on whether or not some kind of permit application is approved.
Back in 2020, then EPA Director Andrew Wheeler said that the move was aiming to, I'm going to quote here, curb abuses of the Clean Water Act that have held our nation's energy infrastructure projects hostage and to put in place clear guidelines that finally give these projects a path forward, end quote. Was there a sense that this was, an arbitrary barrier to developing energy infrastructure?
Well, I think there was a sense from the Trump administration that it was. As I mentioned, there were a number of states that had objected to various types of proposed discharges on the basis that this would harm the water quality standards. But I think these same states and also tribes would say that, no, this is necessary to protect water quality standards. And one thing that I would mention is that the issue of water quality standards is that when states and tribes evaluate whether or not proposed use will hinder water quality standards, they have to take into account a number of other types of water uses. So far, I mentioned dredge and fill permits and point source discharge permits. That's like, say, from a company or something or a pipeline to a particular water. But there's a lot of other things that states and tribes manage in a traditional way. For example, non-point source discharge permits or non-point source discharge in general, which is not in a permit system under the Clean Water Act, but is a large source of water pollution. For example, agricultural runoff from transportation structures, like, you know, just runoff from highways. All of these things are things that states and tribes consider when considering whether or not a potential point source discharge or wetlands fill will it affects the whole overall water quality standard.
How, under this system, can states and tribal governments take into account risk? And I'm thinking here of a pipeline where if it works normally, there should be little or no discharge and pollution. But in the risk of a spill of some sort, there can suddenly be a lot. How does that factor into these decisions? How much are states and tribal governments allowed to take that risk into account?
I think that under both the Trump and Biden approach, they would be able to take into account risk. The difference between the Trump and Biden approach is that the Trump risk can only be about that potential pipeline discharge or whatever, and how that individual pipeline discharge might affect the waters. Whereas under the Biden approach and the previous approach, states and tribes can consider also the existing amount of pollution that's in the water as a result of those non-point source discharges that I mentioned, right? The cumulative effects of that discharge in addition to runoff from farmlands, runoff from highways, et cetera.
Talking to Steph Tai, law professor at UW-Madison, who researches, among other things, environmental law, looking at this rule change proposed by the Biden administration. We'll get into the process of it just a bit. It would flip back from a Trump administration change under the Clean Water Act, giving ultimately states more authority if this Biden administration rule goes through to block or put conditions on certain kinds of energy projects to take pollution and risks to water quality into effect. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how this works? How much do states and tribal governments, do you think, have the right, or should they have the right, to stop these kind of projects or put conditions? Or if it's federally approved, should it just go ahead? Do you have concerns about the impact on energy production and flow thereof? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Steph, Wisconsin has, and neighboring states as well, have pipeline projects that are controversial. They're in the courts often. Does this rule we're talking about have much to do with what we're arguing about here in Wisconsin?
I mean, it can, in the sense that it allows for more opportunities for states and tribal governments to sort of object to particular types of uses of water. So to that extent, it does. To the extent that it affects the approval, other types of approval for, say, pipelines and stuff, somewhat, but not entirely. That is, approvals for pipelines and things are supposed to be based on an overall analysis of the environmental impacts, but also other types of legal matters, and this will affect that overall evaluation.
Now, the thing about pipelines is, of course, they're long. They go across jurisdictions from state to state and across tribal boundaries, as we know here in Wisconsin. Is part of the Trump administration rule change that would be overturned under this proposal, is part of the goal here to say we can't just let one jurisdiction block something for everybody?
Yeah, I mean, one interesting thing about this proposal is that the Biden proposal is that not only does it allow for sort of expanded, or not expanded, because it's basically going back to the Obama administration approach, this more comprehensive consideration by states and tribes, but it also allows for inputs from neighboring jurisdictions, which means that it sort of looks at the sort of overall structure of the project versus an individual kind of stakeholder participation in the project.
Now, this is a proposed rule change. It's something that doesn't go through Congress. The administration puts it out there. Can you talk us through the process and the comment period and things like that that have to happen between now and this taking effect?
Yeah, so when a proposed rule is issued in the Federal Register, there's a certain number of days for comment. It's usually 60 days, although I don't remember the amount of days like available for this. But what happens is that various stakeholders, including members of the public, but including pipelines, including tribes, everyone can submit public comments. And that's something that everyone listening to here can do. And the comment process is not like, say, commenting on a newspaper article. It actually has some legal validity in the sense that if you're commenting, agencies have to take into account the substance of that comment, not necessarily each individual comment, but they have to address that in their final rule. And if they don't address that adequately, that can be overturned by a court. They need to at least take a non-arbitrary and capricious approach to all the submitted comments.
What do they end up doing with those comments? I'm guessing, is there a prospect that negative comments would lead the Biden administration to say, no, we're not going to do this after all?
Well, it might lead them to not do it after all, but it might lead them to limit what they're doing or to curtail what they're doing. I mean, this happened in the Trump kind of proposal, too. There was a period for public comments, which is required under the Administrative Procedure Act. And they didn't really narrow their approach that much, but they did address all the substance of the comments, saying, oh, we don't think this matters because X, Y, Z. That said, that's what led to their rule being stayed by a Northern California district court, which in turn ended up being rejected by the Supreme Court. There's a lot of stuff about that, but the sum of it is that what that means is that agencies at least need to address those kind of comments, and that will be taken into consideration by courts in any kind of legal challenge.
And speaking of courts, now under the rule that we would go back to under the Biden administration, if this goes ahead, say I'm a pipeline company and I've gotten my federal approval. And then a state or tribal government says, no, we're looking at it under our standards. It's back off the table, or we're going to impose these conditions on you. Do I have a recourse? Is there a court? Can I go into court and say, no, state, your regulations are too difficult. They're unreasonable.
Well, I think first they would need to challenge if this rule comes into place, they would need to challenge that rule in the first place as arbitrary and capricious. And so they would first need to get that rule rejected so that the whole process that the EPA has now designed is rejected. Then if that rule doesn't get rejected, they can still challenge in a more limited basis that determination by the tribe that this kind of violates water quality standards. That's a more subsequent kind of evaluation.
In just our last couple minutes, a bigger picture, we see administrations on a lot of environmental issues doing a back and forth. A Republican changes a thing, a Democrat changes a back, a Republican, and so on. How much of that have you seen in the transition from the Trump administration to the Biden administration?
It's been absolutely a lot. And I've noticed that in a number of different rules. One thing I wanted to point out is that the Biden administration actually did encapsulate one of the Trump administration's things, sort of. So one of the things that the Trump administration did with this 401 rule is that they said, okay, we're going to have a maximum time limit for states and tribes to decide on the water quality certification process of up to 1 year. And the Biden administration actually kind of took that. What they said, and I thought this was really interesting, and I think this is what they're basing their economic value of this rule on, is that they said, okay, we're going to do two things. We're going to say, look, we're going to have states and tribes consult with the EPA and decide negotiatively on what time and time frame it's necessary to evaluate this kind of proposal, which suggests that it can go before a year or it can be up over a year, which is different from the Trump administration because they had a maximum of 1 year. And this means that if the states and the EPA decide that it's too complicated and it's going to take over a year to do that, they can do so. But it also says that if the EPA and the state or tribe doesn't agree on the time frame, then the default is going to be 60 days, which is a much more limited process. And so what happens is it seems to and then the state or tribe would have to apply for extension with a written kind of process. So what it seems to do is it seems to speed up some kind of areas for permit applications, and then maybe slow down other areas. And so it's a really interesting kind of approach. We'll see how the administration applies that, but I think it's not entirely different from the Trump administration's approach.
Now, this is all basically executive action, rulemaking authority granted, in this case, under the Clean Water Act by Congress. Have we seen Congress dig back into some of these early 70s environmental regulations and clarify or change things or limit or expand this kind of authority for the executive branch?
Alas, they have not. I mean, there's been even calls from the Supreme Court to sort of expand that, for example, with the actual reach of the Clean Water Act, which is one of the issues before the Supreme Court this next fall, but it hasn't been something that Congress has addressed. I know that the Obama administration initially said that they were going to push for addressing, say, the overall jurisdiction of the Clean Water Act and various other elements with it, and they didn't really go very far on this.
What are some of the other big environmental stories that you are watching for between Congress, the president, and, of course, the courts, the Supreme Court weighing in on some of these issues?
Yeah, I think the thing that I mentioned just now is going to be before the court. The briefing was over the summer, and I have to disclose that I was part of an amicus group representing water scientists in favor of the Biden administration. But the main thing is that there's a case before the Supreme Court about the reach of the Clean Water Act in terms of what kind of permits are allowable under the Clean Water Act. Is it wetlands that just directly touch surface waters, is it wetlands that are connected in some kind of more seasonal way, all of that stuff. So that's something that's going to be a big determination, and it's going to carve out either carve out a bunch of wetlands from the scope of the Clean Water Act, still allowing them to be permitted through state systems, or it's going to sort of limit the reach of the Clean Water Act.
And how big an impact could that have if that, I think they're sometimes called intermittent waters, if those protections, if the court rules, they don't apply?
Yeah, so the scientists that that my team represents is that it will actually affect, like, compared to the Obama/Biden approach, the Trump approach would limit it by a fairly significant amount. I think like 30 or 40% would reduce it, the coverage of the Clean Water Act.
Steph, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
That's Steph Tighe, law professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, researching environmental and health sciences and administrative law. Been talking about the impact of a recently announced proposal by the Biden administration that would give some authority back to state and tribal governments when making decisions about blocking pipelines, among other energy-related projects that require federal approval. Coming up after the news, the World Bank says we may be in for stagflation in the coming years when economic growth slows down at the same time that inflation goes up. Our guest isn't so sure about that prediction, though. We'll find out what it means, why it could or could not happen, and as always, welcome your calls along the way. Remember, you can follow these conversations all the time, anytime, online at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. On both of those, you can stream the Ideas Network live and check out our archives and coverage from the WPR news team as well. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we hear a special Wisconsin Life conversation with the Milwaukee director behind Hollywood movies that highlight the lives of Black Americans, including Cooley High and Car Wash. Now, the World Bank has released an economic forecast for the coming years. The bank says there's a risk of the return of 1970-style stagflation when prices go up quickly, but economic growth stalls at the same time. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you there for that stagflation back in the 1970s? Do you worry that we're likely to see that happen again? Do you have questions about how the global economy is functioning? Do you see a lot of good news in the economy with the job numbers? Do you worry about the inflation that you see when you buy gas and other products? Maybe a little of both. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mark Koplovich is a professor of political science and public affairs and director of European studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
I know you're skeptical about some of the predictions that people are making about stagflation. We'll get into that in just a moment. But first of all, can you remind us, what do we mean when we say stagflation?
Well, so I actually think my skepticism is because there's a lot of looseness and fuzziness about how people use the term stagflation, right? So I am just old enough to remember stagflation sitting in the gas lines with my dad in the second oil shock. But, you know, when we use the term stagflation, people have always meant what happened from about 1974 until 1980, right? So in the U.S., we had unemployment was 7 to 9%. Stayed above 5% for a decade. Inflation was 12 to 15%, and we had several bouts of negative economic growth, right? So that's sort of the classic era of stagflation in the 1970s and going into the early 80s was sort of those levels of negative economic growth, high unemployment, and persistently high inflation. And so, you know, we have very high inflation today relative to where we've been for the last 40 years, but unemployment is historically low. right? We're at 3.6%. Economic growth is positive, right? We've just basically completed an unprecedentedly rapid and total recovery economically from the pandemic shock. And until last month, real wages were higher than they had been, right, in 2019. So if you look at household income, investment levels, growth, consumption, all of these things, even with high inflation, the average person in the United States is better off now than they were, right, prior to the pandemic. What we're having now is a set of challenges facing the U.S. and especially the world economy, as the World Bank talked about, but it's nothing like this stagflation era that we had in the 1970s.
The concept of stagflation is kind of economically weird, right? Because if you've got a recession and there's high unemployment, that's supposed to bring down inflationary pressures. They shouldn't necessarily go hand in hand, the high inflation and unemployment, right? Why is this kind of a rare beast?
Right. So we tend to think about when inflation is high, unemployment, inflation kind of move in opposite directions. Mm-hmm. That gets at what caused the stagflation in the 1970s was you had the twin oil shocks in 73, 74, and 78, 79. So oil prices, I think, quadrupled, right, in that period. In addition to the underlying drivers of when the economy is doing well and there's economic growth, there also tends to be modest inflation because things are doing well. And when demand is lower because unemployment is higher and people don't have as much income, there tends to be less inflation. That sort of policy-induced business cycle type of inflation. In the 70s, it hit up against the fact that oil prices were rising so fast that was driving up inflation along with the kind of economic downturn we were having. So that's, I think, a little bit of what the World Bank is concerned about now is we're seeing that with energy and food prices rising, both because of the supply shocks of the pandemic and now the war in Ukraine, right? Especially with energy prices and food prices because Ukraine isn't able to export because of the blockade of the Black Sea and Russia's not exporting as much in terms of food. So we're seeing some of those things. But again, the overall performance in terms of the cycle of the economy, the U.S. economy had recovered very well. And, the world economy, absent the pandemic, had been starting to recover. Right. So there's headwinds now in that Europe hasn't recovered as much as the U.S. China has another round of COVID. Right. So I think what the World Bank is calling out is there's a bunch of ominous clouds on the horizon that could mean slower economic growth and higher inflation over the next couple of years. But again, the magnitude of those shocks relative to the quadrupling of oil prices in the 1970s, we're talking orders of magnitude different.
Talking to Mark Koplovich, professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison, looking at what's next for the U.S. and global economies. Some dire predictions out there of stagflation, potentially, the World Bank says. He says, hold on a minute, doesn't look quite that bad. You can join in with your concerns or the positive signs you see in the economy globally, nationally, or in your own community. 800-642-1234 is the number for your comments or questions. That's 800-642-1234. Mark, let's tease things apart now. In the current day, we've got inflation, as you say, higher than normal for the last handful of years, not as high as that era in the 70s we've been talking about. To what extent is this a U.S. story of inflation versus a global story of inflation?
Yeah, there's a lot of debate and discussion of this. I fall down very much in line with what Janet Yellen told Congress yesterday, which is that, the inflation is primarily a global shock because of the pandemic, because of the supply chain problems, because of the war in Ukraine. And incrementally on top of that, the U.S. has had higher inflation until the last month or so than other major economies in the world because of the fiscal stimulus we had, right? The American Rescue Plan and stimulus checks and whatnot. That contributed, the estimates I've seen, on the order of 2 to 3% of what is 8.5% inflation, right? So if you think about the differentials between the United States and Europe, those have closed in the last month or two because Europe is much more vulnerable to the energy and food shocks than the United States is. But the majority of the inflation has been this common global shock, right? I mean, if you look across the advanced industrialized countries, you basically see Canada, Germany, the UK, the US, the rest of the European Union, you see a similar 5-6% increase in inflation, right, since the pandemic. Now, ours was higher in the middle of last year by 2.5 percentage points because of the economic stimulus. But at the same time, we've had a massively successful near total economic recovery, and other countries, especially the European countries, still are way behind us in terms of the scope of their economic recovery. So there's a bit of a trade-off, right? You've got this global shock causing inflation around the world. You have incrementally higher inflation on the order of about 2-3% in the US because of the fiscal stimulus and the American Rescue Plan. But the trade-off is we've had a much faster, more successful economic recovery. Again, unemployment is back down to 3.6%. Real income and consumption. So if you control for inflation and you look at household income and you look at how much households are able to buy and consume, those levels are actually higher than they were in 2019 prior to the pandemic, right? So, you know, I know we all go to the pump and we see we're paying, you know, $4.89 for gas. I think it was this week, and, you know, prices are going up. But people's incomes went up over the last year and a half as well. And so the real inflation adjusted living standards actually have not declined. And until this month, actually, the wage increases that we had seen over the last year or so were outpacing inflation, right? So that's not true for those at the higher end of the income scale in the last month or so. That's still true for those at the lower end of the socioeconomic scale, that nominal wage increases have outpaced inflation over the last year. So it's a mixed bag, right? You know, there are serious problems, but again, there's a lot in the news about how dire and terrible things are that are at odds with the data and the evidence.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Shane is with us in Madison. Shane, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Your guest just actually touched on it, but I was wondering if they could comment further on the impact on the people at the lower end of the economy, because they're feeling the effects of the inflation a lot more than, I would say, the average U.S. citizen. And even if average household incomes are doing better than where they were 2 years ago, I feel like the impact is felt more severely on people at the lower end of the income scale.
Shane, thanks for that call. For someone at that lower end of the scale, even if their wages went up, the percentage of their income, I think, going to their gas and housing and food, that stuff they have to spend money on, that is going to have a big bite on them, right? Right, Mark?
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, inflation does have a regressive impact, right? And sort of especially if it is on energy and food and essentials, it hits people at the lower end of the income scale much harder. But again, the wage growth that we have seen, right? There's been a lot about the worker shortage in the news for the last year or so. And wage increases at the lower end of the income scale have been much higher than at the top of the income scale. So it's sort of hard to say for any particular person, right, what is the net effect. But the narrative about how much people are suffering from inflation is really at odds with the data that we have, in that, you know, living standards, again, any inflation adjusted metric that you look at in terms of wages, household income, consumption, those have, you know, held steady or increased since prior to the pandemic, right? So for certain individuals, that's not true. For certain parts of the income scale, that's not true. But overall, for most people in the United States, that's true. It's also true that the stimulus checks, the child tax credit, the various, you know, fiscal policies that were put in place in 2021 went more to people at the lower end of the income scale than at the higher end. So, you know, again, this is not to say that people aren't hurting, that inflation doesn't have distributional effects. But the scale of the narrative of how bad things are and the cost for people is kind of, you know, out of proportion to what I think we see in the data in terms of where most people are relative to where they were 2 years ago.
Talking to Mark Koplovich, professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison, looking at the World Bank's economic forecast for the coming years. Some concerns, some bright spots, he says. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We pick up our talk now with UW-Madison political scientist Mark Koplovich about the future of the global economy, concerns about inflation, potential recession, but very low unemployment going on in the United States right now. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Youngston is with us in Rice Lake. Youngston, hi.
Hi. My name's Jonathan, actually. But
Jonathan, I'm sorry. I think we misheard that.
Yeah, no problem. I remember back in the early 70s, I was about 10 to 12, right in that area. And I remember the economy being fairly good until the OPEC crisis, gas prices went up. And then things really spun out of hand, you know, everything. We had a farm and corn went from $30 a ton to $150 a ton in about 2 months, and different things like that. And on another note, during that same time, a fourth grade, fifth grade teacher, he explained how the economy works and inflation and all that. And basically what he said is when people get an increase in wages, you know, a substantial amount of increase, like nationally, then you're going to have inflation follow it, because what's going to happen is all the prices are going to be increased. And so until everything catches up, you're going to have inflation.
I gotcha. Wow. Mark, you gave us two big things to talk there. First of all, wage-driven inflation. Wages go up, so I could charge you more stuff because I know you have more money.
Right. Right. So this is, you know, the jargon for this is the wage price inflationary spiral. And the caller was right. That was, you know, that was a big concern, not just in the U.S., but across the world in the 1970s. There's very little evidence of that right now, right? We sort of, the data we have, what we know is driving inflation. Last year, it was primarily the supply chain problems, right? There were meat processing shortages, so meat prices went up. There were shipping problems. There were semiconductor shortages, so car prices went up. So the bulk of that was not driven by demand side and wage side inflation. And now, if you look in both the US and Europe in the last several months, right, the big things we know, the vast majority of the inflation is energy and food prices. Right. So the, you know, the wage growth is a component, right? And the fiscal stimulus that is linked to income is a component. But again, it wasn't the primary driver last year in the United States or globally, and it's not the primary driver now. And you see that in sort of market expectations too, right? So there's a lot of concern of, all right, in the future, now expectations have become unanchored that there's going to be high inflation. But if you look at the surveys that are done on this about what do market actors expect inflation to be in 5 years from now, it's not much higher than what they expected inflation to be 5 years from now prior to the pandemic. Right. So we just there's not much evidence at all at this point for that sort of wage price inflationary spiral.
Thanks a lot for that call. Willie joins us next in Madison. Willie, hi.
Hi. Well, this is sort of nostalgic, actually, because I, of course, being old, remember very well the Ford administration and the Carter administration. Is there any chance they're going to try to deal with this problem like Ford early on did, where they were passing out buttons that said WIN to everybody? That stood for Whip Inflation Now. Well, when that first didn't work in the first month, they pointed out that you could take that button, turn it upside down, and it would spell NIM, and that stood for No Immediate Miracles.
Willie, thanks a lot for the call. I don't think the buttons themselves worked, but Mark, on a serious note, though, for it's partly at least a global problem for an American government. What options do they have apart from buttons to try to whip inflation now?
Right. I mean, this is the huge political problem, right? So, not surprisingly, the opposition in every country, not just in the U.S., wants to pin inflation on the domestic policy choices of the local government, right? So, you know, a lot of the narrative about it was all about the American Rescue Plan and Biden's policies, or, you know, Jay Powell's policies at the Fed. Is that sort of standard politics? Look, the uncomfortable reality for an incumbent politician is most of the inflation is currently being driven by these global shocks, and there's relatively little that you can do about that in policy terms. You know, so the U.S. has, the Biden administration has kept the tariffs that Donald Trump had. And, you know, the Peterson Institute in D.C. just had a report out today that you could probably knock a point or two off of inflation by repealing those tariffs, because consumers pay the tariff cost of, you know, rising prices for imported goods. The administration has been releasing oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, but that's pushing back against the global prices. You know, ending the war in Ukraine, if someone had a magic solution to do that quickly, you know, would alleviate the energy and food price shocks. But the difficult political reality for the Biden administration and for incumbent governments elsewhere, right, is that these are global shocks. Right. So, you know, inflation will come down when the pandemic is finally done. Inflation will come down when the Russia-Ukraine war is over. Inflation may come down on energy as we ramp up alternatives, right? The Europeans are desperately trying to ramp up alternatives to Russian natural gas. That's going to happen over the next 2 years. That's not going to solve the inflation problem in the next 6 months. And same with food. Right. And so, look, a lot of these concerns, actually, the much bigger concern, and this is what the World Bank report really, I think, was focusing on, are for developing countries, right, which are going to be hit much more by the commodity price shocks and the food prices, and also the spillover effects. If the U.S., if the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank start raising interest rates to try and reduce inflation, many countries borrow in foreign currency, especially in dollars. And so their debt is denominated in dollars. And when the U.S. raises interest rates, that's going to cause, you know, problems for them to pay their debts. So for developing countries, this is a much bigger shock than it is for rich countries like the United States. That was one of the concerns in the World Bank report is, you know, as many people probably remember, one of the things that followed on from the oil shocks and stagflation was the Latin American debt crisis. Right. When Paul Volcker raised interest rates in 1980 in the United States, that led to skyrocketing debt costs for Mexico, Argentina, Brazil, Venezuela. And you could see, you know, one of the concerns in the World Bank report was debt problems and defaults and things like that in developing countries looking ahead. So there's a lot of warning signs. Right. And there's a lot of concerns, as I said, and inflation is a serious problem. It's still at this point, we were talking about the previous caller said, you know, fivefold increase in prices, right? That's not what we've seen with energy prices and even gas prices in the U.S. When you do adjust for inflation, gas prices in the U.S. are lower now than they were in 2008 even. So there's still a long ways to go.
Just briefly in our last minute, we've got a few callers wanting to hear more about oil, some concern that oil companies are profiteering here, why demand isn't going down. Your thoughts, Mark, on oil and gas in particular?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of political talk and chatter. Again, anytime there's inflation, there are claims that a lot of this is about opportunistic price increases and greed of corporations and things like that. I don't think that is the fundamental driver of what's going on. Again, these are global shocks because of big, you know, public health and international security shocks to the system that are leading to supply chain problems and shortages, right? And that's going to drive prices up. So, you know, even if on the margin there's some incremental greed or kind of price gouging by corporations and oil companies, I think that's a really small portion of what's actually going on with inflation.
And very briefly, Mark, inflation at its current levels, how long do you think it's here to stay?
It's already coming down in the U.S. I mean, the stimulus-driven part of inflation is pretty much over, and we're sort of dealing with the global shock in the U.S. You know, I think one of the things that happens is you get this thing called base effects, which is you're looking at inflation relative to where it was a year ago. Right. And so part of what has driven the really high inflation rates is that inflation was really low for a very long time. And then suddenly we had a spike, and relative to where it was in 2020, right, January 2020 or 2019, things were, right, things were much, much higher. So the growth in inflation has already come down, but the level is high, right? And so I think we're still, you know, a year or two away until we're back to, you know, probably talking about 3% inflation or something like that. But
and we'll leave it there. Thanks to Mark Koplovich, professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison, with us looking at inflation, a possible global recession, and more. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, get some great regional travel ideas, learn some history along the way with a great new travel guide to the Midwest. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. Yesterday, we asked you to call in and share your hobbies, and you did. Here's some more of your stories from the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jeffrey writes, "My hobby is metal detecting. I live in Stevens Point, but travel all over the state to detect at old homesteads and anywhere else that has rich history and try to recover some of that. My most enjoyable find was a World War II nameplate that I found when a road was torn out. With the help of Facebook, I was able to track down his only surviving relative and give this nameplate to that family member, his nephew, who then affixed it to a cabinet that displayed his uncle's army uniform and medals. Jeffrey says, to me, that was priceless." Dean in De Pere says, "One of my hobbies is building acoustic guitars. I built furniture for part of my livelihood. Now that I'm retired, I have the luxury of time to build guitars. I hand plane and use mostly hand tools to keep the racket and dust down." And Nicole says, "Mineral collecting, reading, and painting." And Darlene says, "I just passed my four-year anniversary streak on Duolingo learning Spanish." Thanks for those. Keep sharing your hobbies over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time.